far should police agencies go in monitoring social media in the name of protecting public officials? The question was raised in the light of recent emails released by Governor Snyder's office. An email indicated the Michigan State Police knew that a Copper City man made a potentially threatening Facebook post against the governor over the Flint water crisis. The Flint Journal reports an MSP senior intelligence analyst alerted commanders about the post. And the man who wrote the post was on probation after he'd been involved in a 12-hour armed standoff with police. There was an effort to charge this man with violating probation, but a judge ultimately decided not to move ahead with that. Rachel Levinson-Weldman is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. She's an expert in areas of security, privacy, and surveillance. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, we are all very well aware that security agencies and police are monitoring social media for national security, for terrorist activity. And should we be surprised to learn state police intelligence analysts are checking our social media posts for state and local concerns?
Well, I think maybe we should be surprised and maybe a little disappointed. You know, you take this case here, you know, clearly this post is kind of a matter of some concern. There's a potential threat. At the same time, you think, what is the time that's being spent monitoring social media and for what benefit? It certainly can't be a surprise that people were upset about the water situation in Flint. And I think the concern is that you may spend a lot of time monitoring social media, monitoring constitutionally protected activity, whether that's simply communicating, whether that's saying, oh, you know, we're going to meet for a protest at such and such time. You may chill a lot of that activity for not much of any benefit.
Just to get everybody on the same page, I'm going to read this Facebook post in question. Here is the exact quote. It's time for civil unrest. Burn down the governor mansion. Eliminate the Capitol, where the legislators reinstated the emergency dictator law after the people voted it down, and tell the Mich State Police if they use military force, we will return with same. End quote. So this was according to the state police email that was released by the governor's office. So, Rachel, where's the line between stepping on First Amendment rights of free speech and prudently monitoring threats against public officials?
Right. This is the kind of statement where I can understand why, if somebody had come across this, especially given his history, they would think this is somewhat concerning. At the same time, what we're talking about here isn't even just coming across this. It is an entire program to monitor social media, presumably Facebook, where this was from, to monitor presumably Twitter, maybe other sort of social media platforms. And it was done not only through the Michigan State Police, but the affiliation between the state police and the local Fusion Center, which is a much broader center that brings sort of a variety of intelligence operations to bear. Fusion centers do not have a good history of respecting civil liberties, of making good judgments in terms of the reports that they develop, how they share that information. So I think it's a matter of a lot of concern that even if they do occasionally hit gold, that there's an entire program dedicated to monitoring what are likely to be mostly fairly innocuous posts.
Tell us more about the Fusion Center, because I don't think most of us are aware of those and what they are and who runs them.
Fusion centers, they're all around the country. They basically grew out of sort of post-September 11th analysis. The question was, what allowed all of this information about the planning of the 9/11 attacks to fall through the cracks? Part of the answer was simply information sharing. There was a lot of information that had been gathered but hadn't been shared appropriately. So these fusion centers were started up. They're all over the country. And the idea is to bring a whole bunch of different stakeholders literally to one physical place to kind of monitor and to share information. So you have local, state, federal law enforcement, you have intelligence divisions, you have often private industry that are involved, there's big companies in the area, things like that, which in some ways sounds like a great idea. It makes some sense to be sharing information among those different groups and stakeholders. What they have actually managed to accomplish, though, falls far short of what that sounds like. So in fact, they have produced very little of value. They were originally started for counterterrorism purposes, but frankly, there isn't enough counterterrorism work to keep them busy. And so most of them have expanded to sort of this all hazards model where maybe they're helping to, you know, track down petty drug crime, things like that. And they have a history of often releasing reports that in fact relate to constitutionally protected activity. So they have not contributed much in the way of what they were originally set up to do.
I will note that the Flint Journal report notes that this senior intelligence agency is with the state police, and people are now aware that there is an intelligence commander. And I think that is probably something that has not occurred to people who tend to think of state police in traditional police work. I also have to ask, how does this post, the one I just read, how do you think that differs from that very widely publicized tweet from Cher last January when the Flint story became a national story? And I will read the one in particular that got a lot of attention. WTF is going on with power-mad, greed-driven, killer, incompetent politicians. They are criminals. Governor Rick Snyder of Michigan, hashtag firing squad works for me. Now, would that firing squad hashtag be justified in catching police attention?
That's one of the concerns about having police, having law enforcement involved in social media monitoring, because there's going to be a lot of judgment calls to make, right? Is there some post that kind of raises red flags, other ones that don't? When those red flags are raised, what happens? What's the next step? I think one of the concerns here is it seems more likely that this kind of online surveillance is going to play out in the same way that a lot of on-the-ground surveillance does, which is that it tends to be targeted more at members of racial and ethnic minorities, of kind of lower socioeconomic communities, just the same way that we tend to see over-policing or disproportionate policing in minority neighborhoods. Certainly we're seeing with police departments that are very heavily involved in social media monitoring, so to take the New York Police Department as an example, a lot of that tends to be focused quite significantly on essentially Black and Latino men. There are going to be a lot of judgment calls to be made if an officer or an intelligence officer sees a post, thinking not only what are the words there, but who's making that statement. So in one of the examples, you know, there's somebody who actually has a criminal history, was involved in a standoff with police. Mm-hmm. There may be other circumstances where an analyst is just making a judgment on the basis of what they see in somebody's picture or what they see in somebody's bio. And that's a matter of real concern. And this is separate from whether somebody has actually taken actual steps in furtherance, right? This is ultimately words.
That's true. And we should note that the Copper City man who wrote that post about the governor, as we noticed, he'd been sentenced to 2 years probation because of the armed standoff, pleading no contest to attempted felonious assault. There were some other counts that were dismissed at the time that police were trying to pursue, including threats of terrorism, because police say he had made threats against a number of local authorities, apparently in connection with disconnecting his water over an unpaid bill. So if you're looking at that and making that judgment call, clearly that was not the case with Cher. She was using her First Amendment rights.
Right. And I will say the fact that there were counts of terrorism that had been dropped, but that word terrorism was invoked with respect to threats against local officials related to cutting off his water bill, I do not in any way sanction threats against local officials. But the fact that terrorism is used, that was sort of a basis for potential charges, I think also shows, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we're monitoring for the purposes of counterterrorism, for finding terrorist threats. That term is used pretty broadly, and it can encompass a whole lot of things.
And can that then spill over to people making posts on whatever the scandal du jour is? Is that where you could see this going?
Sure. I think that's a concern that, you know, anything that comes up, you know, especially in an age of sort of increasing social media is a very active place for discussion, for learning about issues, for organizing. And if there's kind of a social media flurry, in some ways it's an easy place for law enforcement to follow. They can use keywords and say, oh, what are people saying about this? But ultimately, a lot of what they're doing is following speech, following communication, to the extent that there is even organizing or planning, a lot of that is going to be constitutionally protected.
There's a balance that has to be struck. And I'm thinking of, for example, school shootings, when then people go back and go, oh, my God, look what he was putting on Facebook. Gee, no one did anything. So how do you balance that with, you know, the risk that public officials take that someone could do that versus, you know, constitutional rights?
It is a tough balancing act, and I think that's a great question. And I don't think that we have the precise balancing mechanism yet. There are a couple of broad principles to keep in mind. So one is whatever monitoring that's going on as protective as possible of constitutional rights, of the ability to speak freely, to organize, to sort of not be chilled by the fear that police are going to show up at your door, are going to do more searches based on constitutionally protected activity, and also having transparency to the extent that there is a policy in place for how law enforcement is doing that.
Rachel Levinson-Weldman is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law, where she specializes in security, privacy, and surveillance. It was great to talk with you, Rachel. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.